Welcome to the Gifters Podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Kai. This podcast is sponsored by the GPS Online Program, which teaches you how to turn your story into a successful speaking and online coaching business. For more information, go to ChristopherKai.com. Our guest today is Eric Farber. He's the founder and CEO of Creators Legal, Pacific Workers Compensation Law Center, and the author of The Case for Culture, How to Stop Being a Slave to Your Law Firm, Grow Your Practice, and Actually Be Happy. Eric, welcome to our show today.
Hey, Christopher, thanks for having me.
So did you just say to be happy and to be a lawyer in the same sentence? I mean, just my brother's actually a lawyer. I have a lot of friends that are lawyers. And before we dive into your backstory, a lot of lawyers that I know, they actually never thought about being a lawyer. But for you, did you have a story growing up that gave an inkling that you might have wanted to be a lawyer?
I think it was kind of ingrained in me a lot, right? I mean, I grew up in Toronto. I actually talked about this in the book a little bit. You know, I grew up in Toronto, conservative Jewish family. We talked a lot about politics. We talked a lot about justice. And it was something that I was interested in as a little kid. And I remember a lot about my grandmother used to call me in Yiddish, my little lawyer. And that came, I think, strangely enough, I was the, you know, our family wanted to get reservations at a restaurant, you know, that we couldn't get into. They'd sort of hand me the phone and I'd be able to, you know, sort of sweet talk and negotiate our way in.
So now, how did you even have that ability? I mean, my mom, I would try to, she would be making fries for dinner and she's like, get away from here. I don't want you to set the table. So I'm curious, where did you learn that ability if you're a young boy to get on the phone? That takes a lot of courage, takes a lot of articulation. So where did you feel that you got that skill set from?
You know, I'm not exactly sure where I got it from back then. I probably, you know, I don't know. It was the comedy was a big part of us growing up, right? And so I think that being lighthearted and not worrying about and not being embarrassed by getting on or being scared by getting on. It was maybe I was a little bit of a performer when I was a kid. So maybe that's where it came from. Not having to worry about it.
Like every single time, like, you know what, Eric, we're going to go for dinner this weekend. This is kind of hard to get a reservation. Can you please call up this restaurant?
No question. I was the guy who, like, it didn't matter if it was hard or not hard. It was like, Eric, we're going to go. I would sort of like to do it, right? So I was the kid who got on the phone and dealt with stuff, right?
Fascinating. How did you go from there to going to school and actually becoming a lawyer? Because so many people have certain skill sets, and now if they're nurtured, they're encouraged, they end up using those skill sets. Because your story actually reminds me of a woman named Diana Nyad. She is the only person to swim from Cuba to Florida. And her backstory, she was 64 at the time, 111 miles, 54 hours. But when you ask her why she chose to be a world-class swimmer, she talks about the story about her father. When she was age 5, her father takes her to a dictionary and says, look at this, our name, Nyad, is in the dictionary. So she tells this whole story about how it's like these swimmers they protect. And so for her, at 5 years old, she was destined to be a swimmer. And for you, it seems like your grandmother saw elements of you. And I'm curious how you chose to follow through those elements, whether in high school, college, when you started really to decide that you want to be a lawyer.
I think from a young age and those conversations, you know, those family conversations sitting around the dinner table, and especially the larger family, when there were larger family dinners and stuff, and really talking about justice and talking about politics and talking about, you know, the duty of people to give back and the duty of people to right justices when they're wrong. Right. And there's a lot of wrongs in our society. And I think that was just instilled in me from a really young age.
And so you decided to go to school in Canada or come to the US? Tell us about the journey.
We moved to the US when I was in my teens. So ended up staying. We moved to Phoenix, went to Arizona State and stayed there. And then I left Arizona and came to San Francisco to go to law school here.
And when did you realize that this ability you had was something that was very, very powerful and you can really help people? Any specific cases you've worked on that you can share with us that really gave you an insight of how powerful this skill and this knowledge is?
Well, I always looked at law as, and lawyers as, people who speak for those who can't speak for themselves. And I was very focused on First Amendment stuff that has a lot to do with entertainment, that has a lot to do with media. And my focus was kind of was there. And I ended up representing a lot of people in the entertainment business, a lot of athletes and entertainers. And that was essentially the basic focus of my practice for a really long time. I represented the Tupac Shakur estate for a long time and dealt with, especially in the early days, a lot of the people were taking Tupac's music and selling it illegally, pressing it into CDs that were, you know, that were not authorized CDs, downloads of a ton of music. And he was actually one of the most illegally downloaded artists in history. And so I started out doing that kind of stuff that was really in the early days of the illegal downloads on the internet.
Let's talk about that in case our listeners aren't aware. I mean, back in the mid 90s and late 90s, I mean,
yeah,
you had the iTunes around that time and the podcast. I mean, I'm sorry, the iPod, where in case our listeners may not know, it was like rampant.
Rampant.
I was actually a former singer-songwriter, so I know that world very well. And you were this protector. You were like a superhero in a sense, right? So you end up meeting Tupac Shakur's estate or some of the people involved with that, and ultimately hired you to really help them just manage that whole process and just have all these cease and desist disorders. And what's the process of that? So our artists that are listening, they go, oh, I got to hire this guy.
Okay. Well, I don't do it anymore, so that's okay. Yeah. But that is kind of what happened. And Napster was the big impetus for all of that, right? And Metallica was a groundbreaking band, and they decided that they were going to actually go after Napster. And that was essentially it. I mean, there was just an enormous amount of illegal merchandise that was on the internet. There still is an enormous amount, I'm sure. But with iTunes and these different companies coming together and trying to kind of figure out how to monetize it, which is what has happened. But prior to that monetization time, it was just absolutely rampant. And it allowed a lot of people to grab music and actually press it into CDs and sell those fake CDs into a lot of record stores, which pretty much don't exist anymore. And so I sent out a lot of cease and desist. I sued a lot of people on behalf of the Tupac Shakur estate and others, and pissed a lot of people off. In fact, there was a guy, I think he was in Florida, but even a small time rapper wrote a song where he kills me in the song. And of all the stuff that I've done, I probably like that one the best. I've still got it on an old iPod, right? So that was pretty fun. It didn't, my ex wasn't crazy about it. She thought, you know, time to move to a more secure building, right?
Yeah, but it also, if you haven't pissed people off, you really have made a difference. Yeah, and so that's a testament to your work with one of the most revered artists in the world. And now with this whole hologram world, I don't know if you saw the Coachella a few years back, they had a hologram of Tupac and I believe it was with Snoop Dogg in it. And that was like 6-7 years ago, and it was actually fairly accurate. Yeah. And now many years later. So you go from there to, I think, creating this law practice called the workers' comp. Talk to us about that.
Well, it was interesting, but you know, I was representing a lot of athletes at the time, and I got a call from a manager who had said, hey, have you ever thought about doing workers' comp for professional athletes? And I had probably a couple hundred athlete clients up until then. And I had just been exposed, I think everybody had, to the Malcolm Gladwell had written an article about the concussions in football. And I had just been exposed to that. And I realized that a lot of my clients, they were in that position. I decided I could be in a position to help them. And so we started doing the pro workers' comp for pro athletes. We actually represented Kevin Turner, who was the lead in the concussion cases in the NFL, the lead plaintiff in the class actions. And I started doing the concussion cases for the pro athletes. And we did pretty well at them. We actually represented Kevin Turner, like I said, in his case for ALS. and he had developed ALS, and he unfortunately, we became good friends, and he passed away a few years ago. I'll never forget him. He was an amazing, amazing guy. And we saw that community-based workers' comp, firefighters, healthcare workers, restaurant workers, et cetera, that they needed top-notch representation, which I don't think really existed. There are some good lawyers out there, but we could do it better. And that's where Pacific Workers was born about 6.5 years ago. And so we have become one of the largest workers' comp law firms in California now.
That's great. Interestingly for me, Eric, as I'm sharing your story, you go from being this pioneer for the bootleg world of getting back people's rights to the whole concussion. We never really thought about that until you had movies, I think with Jamie Foxx or with the ALS, where you're seeing that, but you're literally at the forefront because again, everyone needs a lawyer. You're like that superhero, right? And now I know you wrote a book, so let's talk about those books because I want the listeners to know that if you happen to, let's say, get one hit, you're like, oh, that's a one hit wonder. But in your case, it's like you have this Tupac Shakur in terms of the pirating stuff and then the concussion, but these are like these very, very trend setting headline type topics where you're actually at the forefront. So that being said, talk to us about that book that you said is already called the culture aspect of your business.
Yeah, we set up Pacific Workers and it was about 6.5 years ago and we had some really good marketing. I like to think of myself as a marketer as well. We had some really good marketing. We started to grow unbelievably fast. And I all of a sudden found myself head of a company and I had never really done that before in that kind of way. And I've really been more of a solo practitioner lawyer, small, very small firm lawyer. And all of a sudden we're 4 people, then we're 10 people, then we're 15 and then 20. And I'm like, what, you know, how do I run this? And we had terrible, terrible turnover and it was costing us an absolute fortune. And I started, you know, sort of waking up very early every day, you know, that Tim Ferriss wake up at 4 a.m. stuff, right? And reading every day. It was the only time I was actually going to be able to learn. And I just became a constant learner. And I wanted to learn how to run the business really well. And I I learned that culture and really putting all of your focus as a leader on your people was how you were going to win the war. And we started focusing everything we possibly could on our culture. And I realized that law firms just never did that. It didn't matter what size they were. It was a complete rarity.
Why do you think that is, by the way?
You know, I think a lot of it is that lawyers aren't really shown that their businesses are businesses. So they don't really pay attention to that side. And the larger law firms, I don't think it was ever really instilled and they've never really thought of themselves as businesses. And so it's a complete lack. And it's not just lawyers. I think that probably goes for accounting firms and that goes for dentist offices and medical practices, et cetera. And really culture should be the way that every business runs, a complete focus on stakeholders. And in fact, I think that America itself would be a lot better place if we started thinking about capitalism in the way of conscious capitalism and not greed capitalism. And that comes from a flip on its head and saying that the stakeholders are the most important, not the shareholders. So it's really a stakeholder versus shareholder theory of capitalism. And I bought it hook, line, and sinker, and we started focusing that way. And once we did, not only did our turnover get better, our bottom line got better, our customer service got better, our people got better, and we were able to start growing in a way that we are now, for a small law firm, we're now almost at an 8-figure-a-year income, gross income, and we have less than 10% turnover. And I attribute that 100% to our culture.
So let's talk a little bit more about the culture.
Decided to write the book.
Yeah, no, let's talk about more about the culture because again, it's so many businesses are lacking of many things, but when you say there's this exponential turnaround, given that you were waking up really early, what were some of the key things that your book really shares with in terms of that exponential understanding of changing the culture around and having the lower attrition rates?
Well, I think there's a lot of different things in there, but it's really, to me, it's about focusing on the stakeholders in a real way. I love, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Because it's a great way to run a business. Maslow's hierarchy of needs basically says, if you don't at least give the very basics, right, then you're not going to get to the next level, and you're not going to get to that next level. I think there's a lot of turnover, and they talk about people have all these different jobs and all these different careers and in today's world, and they go from one place to another to another. And I don't think that's actually all that necessary. And I think that has a lot more to do with the fact that businesses don't focus on their people the way they should. And if they did, they're going to get incredible longevity, because the business is going to grow with the people, and the people are going to grow with the business. And, you know, that stakeholder shareholder mentality, to put your stakeholders above your shareholders, that's number one. That's the first thing that any great business needs to do. And there's when you're focusing on the people, they're going to grow. And your job as a leader is to take care of your employees. The employees take care of the clients. The clients take care of everybody. But your real job is to create other leaders. Mm-hmm. You know, in many ways, I looked at it and said, my job is to make myself obsolete. And that's by growing other leaders and growing the business by growing other leaders.
Any specific examples of employees that you've worked with that really, it's a heartwarming story where you really know you are making a difference? Of course, you're succeeding in growing a revenue generating company, but it's all about that heart-centered focus in terms of relationships. Any specific employee stories you can kind of share with us?
I think we've got, you know, 70 great employee stories. There's no question about it, right? But, you know, a couple that really come to mind. It's funny. It's the very first employee we actually had, Irving. I hired him literally in one minute. He was working for a friend of mine when we were getting into broad-based workers' comp. I was down in the guy's office where he was kind of helping me out. And he said, hey, you know, he was our very first hire. And he said, hey, I've got somebody who's really good. He's moving up to go to law school in San Francisco. Maybe you want to talk to him. He sat down and my friend said, hey, Irving, this is Eric. He's looking for somebody. You want to go work for him? And he said, sure. And so I ended up hiring. He now actually helps run the company.
Wow.
Right? But yeah. And one of our second hire, the woman named Carla, who came in, she started answering the phones and she started signing up new cases as an intake person. She never looked at herself as, quote, a salesperson. And, but she was fantastic. She was so good with the people. She had a great manner. And I don't think of salespeople in the traditional way. I think of salespeople as people who can be Sherpas to a client experience. And she was that person. And so she literally went from answering the phone to doing intakes to becoming the manager of the intake department to now training everybody in the firm that comes in. And she's on our exec committee, you know, our management committee. And her voice is there. And prior to coming there, she'd worked in law for probably about 10 years as an assistant. And when she came in to work at our company, I don't think she would have ever thought that, you know, she would go to literally the owner's table.
Yeah. Those two stories are phenomenal. And it really speaks volumes to your book, your culture, and your mindset relative to how you help and train your employees. Now, we're going to talk finally about your Creators Legal. Let's talk about that. Again, you're this pioneering man, done so many different things, but I want to end with just talking about your most newest iteration of who you are, Eric, and how you want to help and serve the world.
Well, it's a new company that is launching really soon, within the next couple of months. And I've been working on it for a long time. And this has a lot to do with the fact that my wonderful people that I work with at Pacific Workers are allowing me the space to go do this new venture. And it's called Creators Legal, and it is essentially the legal Zoom for the creator industry. Filmmakers, indie musicians, podcasters, anybody that's out there creating, they can go to Creators Legal, grab what they need, be protected. It's the democratization of entertainment law, essentially. because it's so hard to find the contracts, to find the things to be protected easily when it comes to entertainment. You got to go to these $1,500 an hour lawyers or $500, $700 that don't exist in, you know, Bloomington, Indiana. And there's plenty of great creators in Bloomington, Indiana, just as there are in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So we're pretty excited about it.
No, you actually remind me of the only two classes I remember most in my university days was my, it was a leadership seminar by a woman named Ann Hicks and a lawyer by the name of David Marcus. And David was a practicing lawyer, and it was a night class that I went to. But the reason why I mentioned this is because that's over 20 plus years ago. And he had this big, thick book, threw it on the table, said, guys, gals, this is law that's taught in school, but I'm going to teach you a law that you need in business, which actually applies to your life. And it sounds like you're doing the same, where we are living in a world where everyone can be a creator, whether you're with Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, now with Clubhouse. And you're right at that point where you're helping people really build their companies. So my last question for you, Eric, is why did you even decide to create this Creators Legal? Like what's the name, like what's the reason behind it?
Well, I think it's transparently necessary, in the words of a good friend of mine who is a singer-songwriter, and as soon as she heard about it. And it comes from a lot of different stuff. You know, my background working in the entertainment business, I got a call from a friend of mine who's a lawyer, is a civil rights lawyer, actually, and he was representing the Oscar Grant family. And Oscar Grant tragically was killed on the BART station a number of years ago. And he said, hey, this filmmaker wants to make a life story of Oscar Grant. Do you have a contract for me? And so I still remember I was actually in LA getting out of a probably an Uber and walking into a hotel and thinking about it. And I said, yeah, I probably got something. So I went upstairs, opened my laptop, pulled something up, sent it over to him. And that, just that act of like, this shouldn't be so difficult for even a lawyer to get this. And that actually was sent over to the lawyer for Oscar Grant, was used for Ryan Coogler to make the movie Fruitvale Station. And Ryan Coogler has obviously gone on to great things, amazing movie,
like
amazing
Black Panther.
Director. Yeah. He's the director of Black Panther and Creed. And I actually had a great, I got to have dinner with him. I used to represent a guy named Andre Ward, who was a world-class boxer, one of the best boxers in history, an Olympic gold medalist. And Ryan wanted him in the movie. So we went to dinner with him, and I had this wonderful conversation with Ryan. Amazing. And he did not realize that I was the one who had sent over this contract, right?
Well, Eric, thank you so much for being on our show. I hope our listeners really reach out to you, because ultimately it's not a coincidence that you're working with the Tupac Shakur and Ryan Coogler, I think is his name. And really, we are in the most renaissance version of this current state of mind relative to the whole Facebooks and whatnot. And so I'm excited to have you really help the next generation of creators, because they need you more now than frankly ever.
I hope so. We're really looking forward to getting this thing off the ground, and we will be doing quite a bit of stuff on Clubhouse.
Great.
For creators out there. So thank you so much for having me on.
Eric, thanks so much for your time. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you for listening to the Gifters Podcast. If you want to learn how to turn your story into a successful speaking and online coaching business, go to christopherkai.com to learn more.